AT&T Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox, lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio. You're with Shannon Joy on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Shannon Joy Show. We're broadcasting from the Joy Virtual Studio right here on TNT. So good to be with all of you tonight. It is Friday. Thank you, Jesus. And I am so thrilled to welcome a very special guest into the Joy Virtual Studio, James Melville. He's one of those guys from the UK, commentator, pundit, activist, organizer. You often see him on GB News with people like Neil Oliver and Mark Stein. He's got one of those hot Twitter accounts where I watch it, I read it, and I find myself pumping my fist. Yes, yes, exactly that. In those words, he has such a good handle on what is going on in the world today from a 40,000 foot vantage point. He gets it. And I've been following you for quite some time, James. I'm a huge fan. So glad to have you on the Shannon Joy Show tonight. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. That was some intro. That's brilliant. Thank you. It's like a badge of honor. I'm very humbled. But yes, Twitter seems to be the forum of opinion these days. But, you know, sometimes it can morph into the world's biggest pub argument. But cutting between the clutter and the noise, it can be quite useful to get a message across. And in particular, trying to give a message and an amplification of that message to millions of people who possibly feel that their voices can't be heard. And I think right now that is particularly critical, especially what's happened over the last 2 or 3 years.
Twitter is on fire right now. Elon Musk walking into Twitter headquarters with the kitchen sink, ready to do business, letting go of 5,000 plus Twitter employees, I think is the estimate, the CEO, the CFO. There are literal tears being shed. There is weeping and gnashing of teeth in the blue check world on Twitter today. James, you and I exist in that world. You are very active in that world. We've been experiencing the extreme censorship, the woke censorship for the past 2.5 years in a way we've never seen before. What are your thoughts on this turn of events 2 weeks before the midterm elections in the United States of America? It's astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hilarious. I think what's happened today is annoying all the right people. But bizarrely, those right people are quite a lot of the people who would have been on, I hate using the phrase, were on my tribe before the pandemic started. I always see myself as someone who's slightly left of center and actually voted Remain in the Brexit referendum. But what's happened the last 2 or 3 years is everything's gone topsy-turvy. As Carl Sagan said, it's like the world of the bamboozle.
Yeah.
Everything's inverted. And so it's not really about left versus right anymore, or liberal versus conservative. It's now about, I would say, authoritarianism versus a form of liberalism, as in classic liberalism, stroke libertarianism. And so what's happening today with the Musk thing is hilarious. I'm a great believer in free speech, and if someone says the wrong free speech, then they have to deal with the consequences, but they shouldn't be cancelled. Mm. And what's happened over the last 2 or 3 years is a lot of people, especially on social media outlets, have been booted off because of sometimes having the correct opinions.
Right.
Or having opinions that the science... Remember that? The science went backed up, and the data has backed up many of the opinions that have been cancelled and kicked off. And I have a problem with that. A lot of good accounts have disappeared. Hopefully they will come back. But actually to watch a sort of howling at the moon today by various predictable commentators on social media about Elon Musk is hilarious. But I'm all for freedom of speech, and if those accounts can come back and if Musk can modify certain things to Twitter, which I'm sure he will, ideally something like an edit button would be quite handy considering,
absolutely,
you know, it's very easy to make typos. I'm all for those changes, and it's ruffling a few feathers, which is always a good thing. But the bigger picture is that we have gone through a lot of suppression over the last 2 to 3 years. It seems like the thought police are everywhere. And as someone who's sitting on the left of center, I'm bamboozled and actually appalled at times by people on the left who used to be the left used to be the champions of free speech.
Right.
They used to be the ideology of criticizing government, big corporates, big pharma, aspects of globalism. And now they seem to slavishly be following in behind of this. I think the pandemic and what happened in terms of the response to the pandemic has changed the rules of engagement. Mm. And social media is part of that.
And we're right in the middle of it. For whatever reason, Twitter just seemed to be that one place. And there are all sorts of media outlets out there. You have right-wing media, left-wing media. You have the mainstream media, the big, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC, Wall Street Journal, LA Times here in the States, you know, to name a few. And so they're going to do what they do. And as a population of people, we kind of make our choices. And over time, I think people on the right would consume right-wing news media. People on the left would consume left-wing news media. But Twitter was this weird space 3 years ago where thinkers and commentators from the right and the left began to populate and ideas began to clash with one another on this space. Not Instagram, not Facebook, not all the other media outlets. For some reason, it was Twitter. I have no idea why. But this really does seem to be where the battle is being fought in terms of freedom of speech and First Amendment. And to your point, so many people, it's going to be interesting to see what Elon Musk does, because we have people like Daniel Horowitz and Dr. Robert Malone and myself. My original account is permanently suspended. I snuck in. Yeah. Yeah. I'm one of the permanently suspended. Naomi Wolf, it continues to be, yeah. I believe, permanently suspended. Dr. Peter McCullough, RFK Jr. And so what is going to happen? Are they going to get their accounts back? Are they going to get their followers back? It's just a wait and see kind of situation.
It is. There may well be a few people within HQ Twitter over the last week trying to press sort of delete on various accounts last minute. But I think, you know, whether they get their numbers back or at least get their platforms back, that's the important thing. And if they, you know, worst case scenario, they have to start again, at least they're back. Mm-hmm. I mean, for instance, will Donald Trump come back?
Right.
I mean, who knows if that happens? I mean, for me, I've never understood the toxicity around having different opinions. You know, I've got friends who and family members who've got all kinds of different opinions. We squabble all the time about politics. But what we tend to do is have a civilized debate, quite passionate debate at times, hopefully learn from differences and opinions, agree or disagree. And if we come on with our own facts, we debate properly. Right. And then at the end of it, we have a wry smile. We either nod or shake our heads and clink glasses. That is the art of respectful debate. But then you see on social media, I think it's amplified the worst of debate because it's become about a battleground. It's become about abuse. There's a toxic element. People pick their sides and go down their rabbit holes over and over again. And actually, one of the most empowering things, I think, in debate and political discourse is actually to go, after listening to someone, do you know what? You might have a point there. I'm going to go and learn about this.
Right.
And then come back and debate again. You know what? You're changing my mind. And then actually having the gumption to say, do you know what? I'm convinced. I'm changing my opinion. You know, I've got my core political beliefs, but there's certain things I've changed my opinions on. I mean, COVID response is a perfect example. I mean, I'd largely supported the first lockdown.
Wow.
But by the time we got to the summer of 2020, the collateral damages were stacking up in terms of delayed non-COVID treatments, mental health issues, kids' welfare, elderly isolation, and also some warning signs about the economy, which is obviously being played out two years later. Mm. But I felt that I needed to investigate research further and then change my mind very publicly about what was happening in terms of the response, and then got a heap of abuse from a lot of people on my side simply because I changed my opinion.
Can you tell me about, was there a specific moment, a specific thing? Was there something that kind of, I guess we would call it maybe the straw that broke the camel's back for you, where you were kind of, this doesn't make sense, that doesn't make sense. And then all of a sudden it was just something, okay, I need to re-examine this. You mentioned that you then went into a period of research and study, and then, you know, the outcome, losing all of your friends or a lot of them, which I think a lot of us can relate to. But in that summer of 2020, can you point to something that triggered that for you?
Yeah, I think there was three examples. I mean, I think I started following the Sweden model quite closely, which is pretty much aligned to what some people in the UK were trying to push through the Great Barrington Declaration.
Right.
And initially, I was critical of Sweden at the start. I mean, their figures in terms of death rates were per capita were way higher, but they held their nerve. And actually, you look on 2 years later in terms of excess deaths in the round, all aspects of mortality, Sweden is one of the lowest excess rates in Europe. So they got it right. They've got better healthcare systems. They've got probably a healthier population, better infrastructure around health, but they've largely held their nerve. But in the short term, people were seeing them as an outlier in a bad way. So I started looking at Sweden, some of the data that was going on there. I started looking at some of the responses that were still lingering in the UK. I mean, some of the stupid rules that were coming in there, like, for instance, rule of six in bars and basically, you know, on off with masks in certain environments. And so,
Right? I mean,
it didn't make any sense. It didn't feel like science. It felt like a behavioral experiment. And so I'm quite a logical person. Some people would probably think I'm not, but I actually try to be. And so I didn't understand the logic behind that. And then also at a later date, when vaccine passports came in, that for me was when it went from just, because the British government to begin with was largely flirting with the idea of being like Sweden and herd immunity approach. And then they pivoted after the Imperial College study saying that if they don't do anything, up to maybe 500,000 people might die. And the media went behind that and the government got spooked. So initially the government pivoted to lockdowns, I think, out of panic. But then they started badgering on loads of other aspects of response. It didn't make any sense. So it felt more and more less about panic and more about a form of authoritarianism and a form of control.
Right.
And then vaccine passports, which for me was the ultimate penny drop moment, whereby they're now trying to coerce people, either through loss of employment or not being able to indulge in their social structures, whether it's going to stadium, a bar, restaurant, whatever, on basically a medical procedure that didn't, there wasn't the evidence that that medical procedure was doing anything in terms of stopping transmission. And I think it was one of the most illiberal and draconian measures to the entire response to COVID, to literally segregate, ostracize, and discriminate people for their own personal medical choice. And that's when I start thinking this is possibly more coordinated than just a government response.
What is so astounding to me, James, is to talk to someone like you across the pond. You're in the UK, and I've had guests on from Canada and Australia and Iran and, you know, just all over the world on the show. And what is always astounding to me is the shared experience, right? That in the US, in the UK, in Scotland, Australia, really Western democracies across the globe, but even some second and third world countries as well, it is the experience is so similar. And their tactics and their techniques, though maybe tweaked a little bit for each individual country population, were so standardized. And that for me was the clue. It was the light bulb moment that this cannot happen in a vacuum by accident. This must have been prescribed. It must have been planned. And, you know, it's interesting. My very good friend, Jordan Schechtel, he has a great Substack and he is doing a deep dive into Event 21, which was that event that was put on at Johns Hopkins University 6 months before the rollout of the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdowns. And when you go back and you look at that Event 20 or 201, actually, they were role playing. They were role playing exactly what they were going to do. And that's what we're seeing happen today. They're broadcasting what they have in store for us. We're going to talk to you about the economic part of this when we come back. But do you see that standardization of process from your corner?
Yeah, I think there's a nudge theory behind all of this. I think if you look at the UK, where the UK government had an organization called SAGE with representatives to advise them on the response to COVID, there wasn't many virologists on that committee, but there was a lot of behavioral scientists.
Oh, man.
Some individuals, I think, were pretty much the sort of individuals you don't want anywhere near government. And I think the government were getting advised by a lot of that. And those representatives were filling up media as well with their commentary, sort of almost like, you know, the sort of doom mongers and the scaremongers of the worst case scenario. And sadly, I think because of a bombastic media driven by governments who weren't being consistent, the public got spooked. And I do believe they ended up a number of different reasons behind that. But I think part of that was the individuals who are peddling the narrative.
It is almost as if it was a sort of psychological warfare, which then, to your point, where you talked about a little bit earlier, used to be you could have a discussion with someone about politics. You could disagree, have a little chat, clink glasses, part your ways. But something changed in 2020. And I do think it was the injection of that fear on a mass media level. It's no longer we're discussing politics. We are discussing life and death, because if you don't put that mask on, I'm going to die, or you're going to kill my grandmother. If you don't take that vaccine, we're never going to get out of lockdown. And so it became very personal to every person. And I think it was on purpose. I think you're right about that nudge philosophy. And I think you're right. The behavioral scientists and the psychologists, they understand how to move masses. And I think they did it very effectively. I think the pushback, the resistance, is training your mind to resist that fear. And I'm seeing it happen more and more. We're talking to James Melville. He is fantastic. Follow him on Twitter. His handle is @JamesMelville. He's a commentator, pundit. He is very active in the UK. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what is going on in the UK. The politics are crazy. I can't even keep a handle on it. Hopefully you can let us know. I want to dish on all of that, James, when we come back tonight on TNT.
TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
British MPs demand Liz Truss resign. As many as 100 no-confidence letters have reportedly been submitted by senior Tory MPs who have not gone public. So UK politics is in a real, real mess. We had Boris Johnson there. Didn't last too long, really, before the knives were out for him. And now the knives are out for Liz Truss, but really, they've done nothing. These politicians have done nothing to address the real issues. So it's no wonder people are upset with them, but they're going back on their promises. They're just so ineffectual. We don't have proper leadership these days, and it's a real worry. You know, we used to have better leaders years or decades ago, but for many, many years, I've yet to see any great leaders in the Western world. It's just really, really sad. We're in a tragic stage in history.
Jeremy Beck on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The story behind the biggest election takeover in history.
We're only now being able to finally confirm exactly how this worked.
Mark Zuckerberg and his wife are donating more money to local governments ahead of the election. $100 million on top of a $300 million gift.
The most money any individual has ever spent to win a presidential campaign in the history of our country.
The election was bought way before Election Day.
They stole it fair and square. They changed the voting rules in the middle of the game.
A nation divided, rigged.
It was a rigged election. People have to find out what happened.
At SalemNow.com.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Despite decades of appeals, mass street protests, and peaceful demonstrations, we're still facing a booming fossil fuel industry and a rising temperature. With the stakes so high, why haven't we moved beyond peaceful protests? We need, in short, to start blowing up some oil pipelines. That's from the description of the book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline by Andreas Malm, on the publisher's website, versobooks.com. Yet, despite authoring that book, the New York Times allowed Malm to pen an op-ed last Thursday. While mocking those activists targeting Van Gogh paintings lately, he wrote, "I tend to think sabotage is most effective when it's precise and gritty. When activists from that same group smashed gas stations in April, they hit the nail on the head. There's a whole planetary layer of stations, pipelines, terminals, mines, and shafts that need to be shut down to save humanity. When governments refuse to undertake this work, it's up to the rest of us to initiate it. That is the rationale for sabotage. And the New York Times printed this trash. What's next? How to murder your neighbor? Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio."
It's never a burden to fight for what's right. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Shannon Joy Show. I am Shannon Joy. He is James Melville. You can find him on Twitter at James Melville. It's one of those accounts that you will find yourself going back to over and over. The hot takes are very hot. He completely gets it. He's from the UK. Things are crazy, crazy in the UK. So there was a tweet, James, that I saw from Kian Bexty, who is a reporter, I believe, out of Canada. He's independent, international. He hops around to all the different countries when there's a big protest or a rally. And I believe he is in either London, he's somewhere in the UK. And he tweets out, there's a ban on heating. We can't turn our thermostat on between the hours of 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. I don't know if this is the case. He's like, I'm freezing though. This is terrible. What is going on? We also have in the UK this, I mean, it musical chairs of leadership, right? And so it's just, it seems so chaotic. I'm dying to hear your thoughts on what is going on in the UK, because it looks like all the economic stuff is really coming to a crescendo in the UK. Yeah. It's a little weird.
I think that the economic stuff is happening everywhere, but there's different cause and effects. I mean, America has got the same inflation problem at the moment. There's reports that America might run out of diesel in 25 days, which is a bit of a concern. But also in Europe, their gas supply and pricing issue and economic carnage is largely linked to Russia and the gas supply cutoff there. But in Britain doesn't export gas from Russia. Just a tiny percentage, I think it's about 3%. It's nothing now. So the British government are often blaming the supply crisis and the gas price increase on the war. It's not.
Right.
There's a number of reasons behind that. I think the British government have decommissioned a number of the storage facilities of gas. The largest one was shut in 2017. So Britain is having to buy, despite being awash in gas, is having to buy a lot of gas from Norway, which is inflating the price, which is utterly ridiculous that is happening. And then I think there's obviously the problems with fuel prices and food prices. And so despite the fact the energy companies, fuel companies, supermarkets are making record profits. So that tells its own story. So they're still making record profits. So they're almost using a good crisis as a form of disaster capitalism. But within that is the politics. And we've got a UK government that has known about increased inflation and the cost of living crisis for most of the last year, but not done much about it. In fact, they've been asleep at the wheel. And meanwhile, within that, we are now in our third prime minister this year.
Right.
And it feels so, like...
Can I ask you about the third prime minister thing? So Liz Truss, was that her? Is that the name of the second?
Yeah, I mean, we almost, all of us forget her name because she was only in power for what?
Hot
50
seconds.
Days.
I mean, talk about 15 minutes of fame. Oh my gosh, she was in, she was out. So Boris Johnson, he's done, right? Because he messed everything up. Nobody wanted him anymore. And then this Liz Truss comes in. She was seemingly a conservative, right? Like, am I correct that that was the perception?
Yeah, I mean, that's all part of the Conservative Party. I mean, Johnson won a mandate with, at the time, an 80-seat majority to say he was going to get Brexit done back at the end of 2019, Christmas election, and still had, obviously, that mandate. But then he hit the skids because of Partygate, where the governor exposed having a number of different foreign parties while lockdowns were going on. So they were telling the country to know their place and shut down businesses, schools and the rest of it. But they were still clinking glasses to the point that basically the government offices in Whitehall and Westminster were the only open hospitality venues in the country at the time, of which one of them was basically happening the night before Prince Philip's funeral. And the Queen had to sit by herself. Remember that iconic picture of the Queen sitting by herself with a mask on at Philip's funeral?
Yes.
The government having parties the night before. So Johnson was struggling since that point. So basically, it's a loss of trust and credibility. And eventually, after a number of resignations in his cabinet, including Rishi Sunak, he eventually fell on his sword and resigned. After a leadership election, Liz Truss came in, who beat Rishi Sunak with a vote with the party, Tory party members. Truss was only in for literally a matter of weeks and then put together an economic plan which went down badly with the markets. People saw it as too much too soon to lower taxes. The markets got spooked. She lost momentum. She wasn't very good at presenting or selling her ideas. And then suddenly, before you know it, she's resigning after 45 days in power, the shortest ever UK prime minister. And then instead of having a 7-week leadership contest this time, like the previous one, which Liz Truss won, we had a 5-day contest where Sunak was effectively made prime minister and leader of the Tory party without a single vote being cast. So it feels like a little bit of a banana republic in Britain, right?
Yes.
Now,
like this guy seems to be installed.
Yeah.
I mean,
Johnson was toying with the idea of standing against him, and they had this weird thing through the 1922 committee, which is like this sort of almost like, it's almost like something out of Hogwarts, where they decide these secret rules within the Tory party, and then they decide their leadership contest. It's ridiculous. Ugh,
disgusting.
And so Johnson got the number required from MPs to go to the voting party members. He had 102, the threshold was 100, but then suddenly mysteriously pulled out. Mm. And then Penny Mordaunt and the other rival pulled out. So Sunak was effectively made prime minister with no opposition and didn't even go to a vote to the members. And it just doesn't feel particularly democratic.
It doesn't feel democratic at all. It feels as if there was a lot of shenaniganizing.
That's a good word.
Backroom deals. You took out this woman that the people voted for. Maybe you like her, you don't. But all of a sudden...
Well, it was only the party members who voted for her. But still, she was only there for...
And then they slide in this guy who, I'm telling you, it looks like he was wound up and let go. World economic, we've seen the marionettes. Here in the United States, we have Joe Biden. It's a weekend at Bernie's presidency. They prop him up. They prop him up in
the
corner.
Well, that's a Manchurian candidate.
Oh my gosh. We have a senator in Pennsylvania. God bless him. It's terrible. He had a stroke shortly after having the COVID jab and is now clearly brain damaged. They bring billboards of him all over the state of Pennsylvania.
Your president doesn't look particularly healthy at the moment either.
No. I mean, it's almost as if they're laughing at us. Like, so this guy that you have in the UK, I mean, he is full on 100% digital currency. The dystopian, we're going to crash the economy and then we're going to give you all basically coupons to survive, coupons for housing. I mean,
this is a big thing of mine. I mean, I did a podcast quite recently on central banking digital currencies with a lot of experts in that field. And it seems like basically there is a mission creep towards that. This isn't a conspiracy theory. If people did their homework, you realize there's countries all around the world that are doing pilot schemes on this right now. In particular, Japan have just announced that they want to move their national insurance card up to digital ID, and they're coercing Japanese people by saying if you don't do that, then you might not have health insurance. And so that mission creep is happening.
Yeah, James Melville, we have to go to break. So because I want to get into central banking digital currency. Just like after 2020 in the lockdown, I told my audience, all roads lead to forced vaccination. It's the brass ring because it represents the government and the corporations owning your body. If they can seize your body and force you to be vaccinated, it is a 21st century slavery. Game over. They own your body. I think now with this new manifestation of this global order, whoever they are, this central banking digital currency, it's the brass ring. Everything, you know, messing with our supply lines, labor shortages, all of the devaluation of our currencies through government manipulation, all of the inflation that is created also by our governments and corporations. This is all leading us to the end goal. And that is all of us on a new global digital currency. It means they control everything. Everything about your life. It should terrify everyone. And James Melville has done the research. He's an expert on this. When we come back, we're going to talk about this in detail so that people can understand what this means, for the future, for your children. It's incredibly important. We'll be back in a moment on The Shannon Joy Show.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. The European Commission has warned Elon Musk must comply with EU rules after acquiring the social media platform Twitter. Rishi Sunak has shot down suggestions from Daily Show host Trevor Noah that backlash against his installation as prime minister was a result of his ethnic background, saying that the UK is not a racist country. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, was violently assaulted this morning in a San Francisco home invasion.
don't miss a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. Available right now to download. Keeping you up to speed on TNT Radio.
Welcome back to TNT. I am Shannon Joy. Tonight, joined by James Melville. You can find him on Twitter. It is a must-follow account, at James Melville. We're now experiencing a bit of free speech on Twitter, so that's super fun, super exciting. James, we left off in the last segment talking about kind of a big topic that is confusing to most people. This idea of a global digital currency, a new type of central banking. For those of us who are looking at the globe from a holistic point of view, so we're watching everything. We're looking at how economics ties into foreign policy, ties into COVID-19, ties into the vaccines. And there are some of us, I think in our circles, you included, that kind of are beginning to understand this bigger picture. You can't understand COVID fascism or the bigger picture without understanding the economic element of it and what their end game goals are. You have a really great understanding of this. What have you found in your research and the interviews that you've conducted on this topic impacting not only the UK, but Western democracies across the globe?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this is by design, because I think you have to go back a bit in time. The fiat monetary system is a busted flush. I think it's been heading that way for a while, but in particular, the catalyst of that, I think, was around 2008, 2009 financial crash, whereby to bail out the banks, governments leveraged up debt, and a lot of the ways they leveraged up debt was through a thing called quantitative easing.
Yep.
And if you look at basically the charts of quantitative easing, they were quite high back then in 2009, and they sort of remained quite high. But then over the pandemic period, they went through the roof, in particular in the UK and the US. In the UK has added pretty close to 500 billion of quantitative easing, which is effectively printing money, as a way of paying for the pandemic response. You know, when you get millions of people sitting in furlough getting paid,
right,
not at work, and then there's a response and all the cost of the PPE and the rollout of the vaccines and everything else, and bailout of businesses, that money has to come from somewhere. And so Britain's national debt has gone through the roof since the Tories have been in power over the last 12 years. National debt's gone up from about 800 billion to north of 2 trillion. And so the fiat monetary system is wobbling. And I think, to cut a long story quite short now,
that's okay. We have some time. I mean, you can luxuriate. Yeah. We have a little time.
Thank you. That's great. This model isn't sustainable. And I think that what they've got now is a technology in place whereby, and so therefore, if you look at COVID, they tried to basically tie people in through the app, the track and trace, and also through the vaccine passport as a kind of conduit to forms of digital ID. A lot of countries are rolling out other aspects of digital ID. They're trying to tie in aspects of net zero response to digital ID as well.
Can you explain that tying in net zero to digital ID?
Yeah, well, there's certain countries. I mean, it's, you know, Canada looked at this, Germany looking at this, whereby if someone's carbon footprint is good and it's monitored sort of in a digital way on an app, then they will get rewards and points for that as well. I mean, there's been a sort of few trial runs of this, even in Italy as well. So, you know, it's a kind of almost like a trial run of toe in the water of social credit systems.
So if I take cold showers every morning, give me a gold star. Yeah. And
well, I quite like a cold shower. That's quite a good thing. It's good for your health. I might do well on that score. But I think the way of getting everyone tied in is through finance. And if, for instance, there's a system whereby effectively central banks are controlling the financial mechanism, that concerns me, because that means people aren't free. They're locked into a government-owned system, potentially, combined with then what levers that could be attached to that. So therefore, if someone is criticizing the government online, what's not to say the government to switch off their bank account? And actually what happened recently with PayPal, where they were sort of deciding the rules about whether they fine people to switch off their accounts because if someone was, you know, being critical online or whatever it might be.
That was $2,500.
Yeah, but that's one person's misinformation is someone's factual information. And so who plays God with the information? And I certainly don't think it should be financial organizations or indeed governments. It's up for basically the people deciding. You also add in fact checkers, self-proclaimed fact checkers, and look at their finance models. Who's funding the finance checkers? You know, they get funded sometimes in part by pharmaceutical companies. That cannot be a straight line to the truth. There is a conflict of interest. I digress a bit in terms of where we're at with this stuff. I think that their ultimate goal, I agree with you, is a form of central banking digital currency. I think they're trying to nudge it through almost under the radar. Our current new prime minister, it depends on the prime minister is each week in Britain. It seems to change a lot. But at the moment, we seem to have Rishi Sunak as our prime minister. So we're looking at...
Rishi Sunak. Sunak, okay.
Yeah, Joe Biden got it wrong recently. He mispronounced it, but our Prime Minister's called Rishi Sunak, and he has advocated central banking digital currencies for quite some time. When he was Chancellor, he has put a couple of videos together advocating why this might be advantageous as well. The problem I've got with this, we obviously don't know what the rollout would be in the detail if they do it, but the risk that's attached to this is obvious, because it is effectively tying people up to financial control as a conduit driven by the government. And with that, that opens up the potential for aspects of social credit systems. You know, Britain and America, we're not China. We shouldn't be going down that path. You know, Britain and America, for all the faults that it has, are fundamentally pillars of liberal society and freedom.
Right.
Traditionally, they were. They should always be that way. A sense of liberty is born out of a number of countries, Britain, America being two of those countries. And the idea of moves afoot to create a form of digital banking, central bank digital currencies, is an appalling one. It's an affront to liberal democracy.
And so the play here is to either slowly or quickly, we really don't know what they're going to do in terms of the next, you know, 3 to 6 months. It, you know, in the United States, James, we are calling it a controlled demolition of the economy. So they are attacking supply lines. They are attacking all sorts of industries in different ways. And here in the States, the housing market is just being crushed. It's unlike anything I've seen ever. In the United States of America, home ownership is a pillar. And I have been talking to so many people who not only cannot find a home or get a home, interest rates are going up, home prices are going through the roof. I believe all of this is managed. I believe that all of this is manipulated. But you also have now rents going up. So it's not even that people can't get into a home. Their rents are skyrocketing. I talked to a young woman whose rent is, her rent for an 1,100 square foot townhome in the suburb of New York is more than my mortgage for a 3,600 square foot Victorian home in a beautiful village. It's insane. It's insane. And I'm watching this. And so, you know, they put on the squeeze. They basically impoverish everyone while rewarding the big banks and the big mega corporations and the big box stores and Amazons and all of the tech companies. And they just crush the little guy, little, you know, small independent businesses. And then when we're all devastatingly poor, they say, okay, well, now you have zero money. You're about to lose everything. We're going to give you this new currency and you're going to love it. It's going to be double what you had before. But oh, by the way, you got to run it through the government or whoever. There is no government. Who are these people anyway? I don't even know. They're right. It's when we talk about who's controlling this, none of us know who's going to control this. We just know that our bank accounts can get shut off. And you can't, I mean, if eggs are rationed, you can't get eggs. You can't spend your money. I mean, when you have a dollar, you can spend it any way you want. You can go anywhere you want, give it to anyone you want and spend it in any way you want. When they control your digital currency, they can turn it on. They can turn it off. They can nudge you. They can punish you, to your point, if you have wrong speak or wrong think on a social media platform, or you consume too much hot water or cold water or energy in your home that they're also monitoring. This is insane. This is full on totalitarianism, James.
Completely agree. I mean, it's a Trojan horse to something else, tech totalitarianism. I mean, it's if you've got, for instance, you have to have cash in society, because if you don't have cash, then there's millions of elderly who don't have access online. They don't use digital banking in any shape or form. And there's flaws with that. I mean, it's a strong wind example. I was at Street Market in a town called city called York in the UK at the weekend. There's a fantastic street market, and the street sellers were ideally wanting cash because the Wi-Fi signal in that area for the street market had no signal. So they needed that cash payment. And there's a lot of organizations, retailers, and also transport networks are now refusing hard cash. You need that hard cash because there's a backup. For instance, if there's a digital crash, then at least you've got cash to pay for things and transactions. There's also, you know, everything's so wired digitally that it's not just about cash. It's all about infrastructure systems, healthcare, finance, everything. That crashes, then the whole system comes down. So cash is the backup again in a lot of ways. Elderly need cash, but that's just one component of it. There's another aspect, and that's about civil liberties. That if we're tied into this central bank digital currency, then our civil liberties are literally put on a line that the government can cherry pick about. You can have this one today, or we take that one away, dependent on your lifestyle choices and your behavior, and whether we see fit, whether you can actually be accommodated by us in society. It's a slippery slope.
It is a dystopian nightmare of a future, and I want nothing to do with it. I really, James, it just makes common sense. You want all sorts of different types of transaction in terms of, I like Bitcoin, I like digital currencies, I like stocks and bonds and commodities and cash and barter. There are all these different ways.
Yeah, you put it all into the mix.
You add them all to the mix, people use what they want, and that way no one nefarious group or person or organization can get control of it. So I'm not opposed to a digital currency, so to speak, right? But it's got to be one in a mix of a lot of different silver, gold, you name it. Like, they're all different ways for us to conduct our economic business. And frankly, I think this just reeks of, once again, mega maniacal control freak lunatics who have just accumulated way too much money, way too much power, and way too much time. And now they've gone, lost their damn minds. The billionaires are after us. And I'm sorry, I just don't want it. I don't think anyone should want it. And I think that's why you and I, and so many of our colleagues across the globe, are fighting back, not just fighting back, but raging against this. People should be raging against
this. We need more people to understand the repercussions of this, though.
Absolutely. We're talking to James Melville. You can follow him on Twitter. He's a commentator, pundit out of the United Kingdom. He's often on GB News, which is one of my favorites, and just has such unique and informative takes on Twitter, at James Melville. We'll be back on TNT in a moment.
I was scheduled for a huge climate debate in England, and then all hell broke loose.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
In October 2022, Lord Christopher Monckton and I were scheduled to debate at a climate conference in London. The so-called Global Investment and Sustainable Development, or Green Davos Summit, was hosting a climate debate. But when word got out, all hell broke loose. The UK climate minister canceled his attendance. The minister cited, quote, unforeseen urgent government business for his decision to withdraw from the conference. Monckton and I's debate opponent, Dr. Aaron Theory, backed out of the debate. I went on One America News TV in the U.S. and explained my debate challenge.
I will say this, and anyone, this is like WWF wrestling now.
Listen here, I'm getting on a plane this weekend, and I'm coming to London, and I'm going to debate, and if you try to block me out, I will be there at the door. You will not keep me out.
All right, that's a little out of control. That's my WWF World Wrestling Federation chant there.
For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live.
Final segment of the Shannon Joy Show on Friday. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. You know my rule: rest, relax, spend time with your families. Do not think about politics, not even for 1 minute, because you need to rest your mind and we need to be ready to fight again on Monday. We are in it. This is a battle. I think it is a battle for humanity. I think that it's going to play out over the next 3 to 5 years, maybe 10, I hope not, but it's for all the marbles. They have put this forward. They're playing for keeps. And the question is, are we the people going to fall for it? Are we the people going to be too afraid to stand up and speak out and rage against it? James Melville joins me tonight for this final segment on The Shannon Joy Show. He is a commentator, a pundit out of the UK, and you can follow him on his Twitter handle at James Melville. He's part of the resistance. James, what do you think this looks like? How are the people in the UK responding to this? I'm always interested in the resistance. Are people aware of this? Are they acknowledging it? Are you sensing an awakening? Is there pushback to, you know, the new prime minister and these dystopian plans? Where do you think you guys are at?
I think this, I've always said this throughout, this is four different communities. There's people like us who are largely aware of what's going on. Then there's a second community where people have been completely brainwashed and live in fear because of endless scaremongering with our bombastic media over the last 2.5 years. Mm. There's people who quite, in some ways, secretly enjoyed all of this, you know, because they've got agendas and they quite like the fact that, you know, they might be effectively taken care of. Mm-hmm. And then there's the final community where it's the most important community, and that's the silent majority who know in their hearts that something's afoot and something's up, but they are probably too afraid to say so. And that was particularly relevant as the pandemic response carried on into beyond a year. And then, you know, aspects of vaccine passports came in. So I think the public, for me, the majority of people in the UK get their information and their news from mainstream media, in particular things like BBC and the newspaper of choice.
So that's similar in the US. We have our mainstream news media, and most people are just dialed into it.
Yeah, they are. So it's not often, it's quite often not what the mainstream say, it's what they admit. It's what they don't put in. The news is very, very restricted. It's on particular paths and particular topics, and loads of stuff is completely ignored.
Right.
And so the mainstream media are not really covering things like, for instance, central banking digital currencies, despite the fact the governments are, you know, sort of working under the radar to try and put them through in pilot schemes. So, you know, we've got to be careful. What I try and do is communicate to friends and family who about what's happening here and now, maybe one step beyond rather than going five steps beyond, that just sort of turns them off.
Right.
And I think the one thing that unites everyone right now is the cost of living crisis. And so unlike lockdowns, for instance, where which is quite a divisive issue, and it's difficult to try and have discussions with people who have a different opinion. People, you know, there's a lot of emotion tied up with that, as you touched on earlier.
Right.
So, you know, people saw it as a life and death thing. And I sort of understand that. But I think with the cost of living crisis, there's a lot of anger with the government. There's an anger the government haven't done anything in the UK for months on end. Inflation is rocketing. Prices are going up. And they've been squabbling, indulging in a sort of Poundland Game of Thrones leadership contest. And so if we harness that collective anger, which I think the fear is now being replaced by anger in the UK about bad government, then we've onto something here about, well, okay, right, we all agree on this one. Now we need to have a discussion about why this is happening, why in terms of government response, in terms of the agendas that play around this, about what the outcomes might be in a year's time, things like central banking digital currencies. And I think that's how we win support. So I think the majority of people are just seeing it for what it is in the here and now, and that's a cost of living crisis. The vast majority of people, and I'm sure it's the same in the States, have no idea about some of the aspects with digital currencies, for instance, that may well be coming down the tracks.
Do you see it as a concern? So if we're talking about, and my good friend Edward Dowd, he calls it the marginal mind or the marginal middle. Like that's who we're fighting for right now. The game has been set. There is team reality across the globe. People like you and me, people who are like looking at this, we understand the stakes, we understand the game. And then we have our adversaries on the other side. They know exactly what they're doing as well. And then you have this kind of muddled middle that is very confused right now. And Edward refers to that as the marginal mind, and that's who we're really going after. It's also a concern, though, because when you have this marginal mind that is angry about cost of living crisis, they're angry about inflation and energy, right? And they're rising up and they want a solution. They want a solution. Isn't that exactly where our adversaries want them to be? So that when they come in with the solution, the people won't realize it's a trap.
I completely agree. It's exactly like COVID response. So basically, problem is created. Right. Governments, and from that problem, then there's a sense of panic and unease and insecurity, instability. Then the governments sweep in to provide the solution to the problem, but their solution creates a whole set of other problems, collateral damages. The same thing, rinse and repeat, is happening here. You can argue that it's actually happening with the whole climate debate as well, where, you know, as an environmentalist, my whole view is about, if you're going to provide a solution, make sure the solution is genuinely sustainable, going to help the planet, not create other problems. Right. But if you suggest that, then you're marginalized as a climate change denier, which is ridiculous. The same way that we were marginalized as COVIDiots, saying the response to COVID was wrong. And now we've got the same thing happening here with the cost of living crisis, whereby people are worried about what's happening in 6 months' time to their lives, where they can keep their houses, their jobs, and so on. They can put food on the table, switch the lights on, turn the oven on, and so on. And I agree. So therefore, another problem. There's another crisis. There's more unease, more panic. And along comes the government to try and solve the problem, ironically, that they actually created. And that's a worry. So we're in this sort of Mobius loop of problem created by the government. Government provides a solution that creates a multitude of other problems that they also created. And so it's like a domino effect of amplified chaos and confusion and disorder by an issue-by-issue basis, all largely cultivated by those in charge. And I personally, I'm sick of it. And I think more people should be, and should wake up to the fact that we're having governments right now who should be serving the people.
Right.
We shouldn't be we shouldn't be serving the government. We own governments. They don't own us. But at the moment, we seem to have governments that I think are not acting in our best interest. And people need to, I'd hate using the phrase join the dots, but people need to slowly but surely work out where the source of the problem is and why that problem is happening. And I think it comes back right to what I said earlier. The fiat monetary system is a busted flush. And I think governments and various technocrats around the world are looking at a new form of reset to try and, you know, not just reboot the financial system, but also effectively exert even more control over mass population.
Well, they need to cover up the crime of completely fleecing the average person with their central banking systems for 109 years of a freaking Ponzi scheme. Excuse me.
Yes, that's what it is. It's a giant Ponzi scheme. Exactly right.
I mean, and it's seemingly complicated, but it really isn't if you try to boil it down and just look at human history. I mean, this story has repeated over 4,000 years of human history. It's always about a group of people who have a lot of money and a lot of time. They have a God complex. They tend to think that they can claim ownership of the world and of people. And, they look at people, you and me, James, as if we are commodities or a herd to be managed and manipulated. And in certain times throughout the history of the world, they just accumulate a little bit too much of that power.
Yeah,
and money, and they go
overreach.
Crazy.
Yeah. With overreach. I mean, the problem with this one, I completely agree with, we always learn lessons of our history. And there is examples of that littered throughout history in terms of exerting coercion and control, social control reasons, with ultimately control of the same things as always, food, finance, energy, fuel, health.
And
actually, religion was part of that as well.
Slavery. Slavery. Slavery was the rule of the game for 3,000, 4,000 years. Only in the past 200 years have we as a collective society said, hey, maybe we shouldn't own other people. Like, that's a very new thing.
It's about the bare essentials that they're trying to control. And but the difference with this one, Shannon, is that the fact that we've got technology that wasn't around before. So previously we'd have these examples where certain countries would go completely off. They would become sort of either failed states or they'd be run by tyranny and dictatorship. So there's always been that component. But because of technology and everything's so much more interlinked, which is, I think, a double-edged sword. You know,
right.
It has positive aspects to that and negative aspects. Positives are that we are more interlinked. We all can communicate. We can do this, for instance, in two different countries. Share ideas, cultures, you know, ideas, solve problems, all of that good stuff, which I think is all the great things of internationalism. And then there's the bad aspect, which basically you can put all these things together and actually get a number of individuals, whether it's to do with corporations, technocrats, and government, who have this sort of grand design to suppress, control, and effectively asset grab across the planet on our basic essentials, such as energy, food, fuel, healthcare aspects, and ultimately finance. And I think that's where we're at. So I think to try and unravel this and push back from it, again, it's a double-edged sword. It's going to be more difficult because they've got more of a toolkit to do it. But it's also paradoxically easier as well because we can all share our resistance to this much easier as well.
Well, in a lot of ways, just say no. I mean, that was one of the biggest reasons.
Yeah.
I don't want your shot. I don't want your currency. And I'll figure out a way to do it on my own. Thank you very much. I mean, it's almost as simple as that sometime. Oh my gosh, we've run out of time, James Melville. I could talk to you forever. Thank you so much for being with me. So enlightening, such great information. You guys can find him on Twitter at James Melville. He is a must follow. And I promise you, we'll have him on the show again. James, have a great weekend.
Thanks a lot. Enjoyed it.
All right. And thank all of you for listening to The Shannon Joy Show. Have a great weekend yourself. We'll see you next week.